From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The historian Joanna Burke says it may surprise you, but it's really difficult to explain what pain is. We all know how it feels to us, but the descriptions are all over the map. Chronic pain, sharp pain, there's the pain associated with panic and fear and heartache. Burke says pain is not so much a physiological process, but a negotiation with our social worlds. So it's not just a sensation. We experience pain through a filter, our emotional state, our culture, our beliefs. And our idea of pain has changed dramatically over the years. Today in the program, Joanna Burke is joining us to explain the history of pain in the Western world. She says if we can come to understand it, we'll be better at dealing with our own suffering and the suffering of others. The book is called The Story of Pain. Join us after the news.
We want to take a moment to shout out The Good Line for supporting this podcast. If you're building a brand, these guys can help you with websites, film, design. They're all about finding and telling stories that bring together a full brand experience. Check out the new Radio West Films website to find out what that means, or you can see what else they do at thegoodline.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You would think it would be easy to come up with an answer for the question, what is pain? But it's not. It's easy to think of it as a physiological process, a physical sensation, but the historian Joanna Burke says it's much more complicated than that. Her book tells the story of pain in the Western world, at least from the 18th century on, and she explains there have been all kinds of theories for pain, scientific ones, philosophical ones, theological ones. Some thought pain was a mechanism to protect the human body. Some thought it wasn't so much a thing as a sign of something else. Some thought it was just God's way of testing the faithful. Joanna Burke is joining us today. Her book is called The Story of Pain, From Prayer to Painkillers. She's a professor of history at Birkbeck College, University of London, the author of 11 books on topics like modern warfare, military medicine, sexual violence. She's joining us today from the Hellenic Radio in Athens, Greece. And Professor Burke, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Yes, hi, Doug. I'm really, really thrilled to be here today.
I want to begin with a story you've told about, I think in some ways, the thing that got you started thinking about all of this. You were in the hospital, and your morphine pump was not working. And so you were in pain. Would you tell the story of how you started thinking about this?
Oh, don't remind me of that awful occasion. Yes, I mean, up until this stage, I'm actually a historian of violence. I'm a historian of inflicting pain. But as you just said then, you know, I was in hospital one day and after a really serious operation, and I was in excruciating pain, and my morphine pump wasn't working, and I kept pushing that button, you know. And, you know, I wanted to be a good patient. I didn't want to disturb the hard-working, you know, night nurses. So, you know, I was a rational person. I thought, okay, I've got to breathe. I've got to distract myself. And I picked up a book that I'd been given by a friend. It's a wonderful book. If you haven't read it, do. It's great. It's a book by Virginia Woolf, published in the early 1920s, called On Being Ill. And in it, she talks really eloquently about the language of pain and how, you know, even the merest schoolgirl, when she falls in love, has a language that she can draw on to use. She's got the language of Shakespeare, the language of all those great love poets. But, Virginia Woolf wrote, you know, she has a pain in the head, she has a headache, and she has no words to express that to her doctor. And I was thinking about this, and it really did distract me from my suffering. Then my partner came to visit, and, you know, I remember, you know, really excitingly telling him, you know, Virginia Woolf, this book, you know, she talks about how pain is inexpressible. It's beyond language. People can't talk about their pain. I was, you know, telling the story in a very excited fashion. And I noticed him kind of smiling. And I thought, what are you smiling about? What is it? And he turned to me and he said, you know, Joanna, you've been talking about the inability of people to communicate pain for an entire hour. And that got me thinking that, you know, maybe it's not the fact that pain cannot be expressed, but that listeners don't want to hear it. it actually hurts listeners to hear someone talking about pain. And that is when, that was kind of the moment that I decided, okay, I'm going to be an even better patient and I'm going to write about this feeling, this thing that we all have, which is pain, which is suffering.
It's interesting, though, that you've written about fear, as you said, about violence, about rape. And so, as you said, a lot of that is about the infliction of pain. And I did wonder, is this book a way of you kind of, you know, working out the professional trauma of all of that,
if you
know what I mean?
Yeah. Yes, Doug, I think it's really interesting you've said that. You know, no one has said that to me before, but I have thought that a few times because, you know, trauma is something that's, well, it's been the heart of my life ever since I was a child. I grew up in Haiti. I'm a New Zealander, but I grew up in Haiti. I've seen trauma all my life. And then, of course, I've dedicated most of my professional career to killing, dismembering, pain, fear, you know, all those sorts of things. And I think that actually trying for me to understand what it means to be suffering pain as opposed to inflicting it was a real shift in the way I was thinking, and actually a way of me working through, you know, what does it mean to suffer? And actually, more than that, what does it mean to look at and to watch someone else suffer and to sympathize with them and do something about that?
Throughout the book, you don't really make a distinction between pain and suffering. And you do this consciously. In fact, this is an important theme. Would you, the idea of disconnecting that Cartesian distinction between body and mind, you're about that.
Yeah, this Cartesian distinction, it's really just a, you know, a posh way of saying that there's, you know, there's something different between the body and the soul or the mind. And so people, you know, when I was writing this book, I said, I'm writing a book on pain now. And they'd say, oh, you mean physical pain or psychological pain? And I was saying, well, actually, there is no such thing as physical pain without psychological suffering. And there's also no such thing as psychological suffering without physical pain. I mean, it's no coincidence that the same analogy that people are given when they are experiencing grief, for example, are exactly the same ones for certain kinds of headaches. So in other words, the mind and the body are always in interaction and you can never separate them. I actually don't think it's been very helpful for people to make that distinction because, well, at the very least, it risks minimizing what actual you real people, flesh and blood human beings, are going through when they say, I have a heartache or I have a headache.
So when people hear about pain, they often think about alleviating pain, stopping pain. But you say rather than thinking about pain relief, that we should be thinking more broadly. The expression of pain, I think, is how you put it in the book.
Yeah. You know, I'm an historian. I love history. And, you know, I've been collecting now for many years, I hate to say this, but decades, people talking about pain, people talking about using words and indeed images and music to make sense of, to visualize, to communicate what they're going through. And what really strikes me as so, so interesting is that the language of pain over the centuries, you know, there are some common themes. You know, let me think. Pain is a fire that burns. It's a dog that bites. It's a knife that stabs. These are common metaphors that people, whatever period you look at, have been using to communicate pain. But, you know, there are other more elusive ways that people have tried to make sense of or give words to what they're suffering. And that's what I've been interested in. And the kind of, I guess you might say, imagination and the creative ways that people draw on language when they're trying to talk about, you know, terrible things that their body is going through. So everything from, for example, you know, 19th century, people would always refer to pain in religious contexts. You know, religion was so crucial. It's the heart of what it means to suffer. So the sufferer, for example, has to give it up to God. The sufferer has to embrace pain because pain is a good thing. And, you know, this is really in contrast to a lot of the things we hear today, which is, you know, pain is something to be fought. Mm. You know, as you just mentioned, we have to take pills, get rid of it as soon as possible. We have to don our armor and kind of fight pain as this kind of enemy. And that's a very different language to what we see in the past, where pain is something you embrace. You suffer in this world so you don't suffer in the next.
I was really surprised, and we'll come back to this, but the anxiety that people felt when anesthetics finally emerge on the scene. People wondering, in fact, if it's noble, if it's good to take them, to relieve yourself of pain. I had no idea that there was such anxiety associated with it.
I mean, I had no idea either. You know, something that's a fact that's so interesting, and that is that, you know, the possibility of alleviating pain was scientific possibility. It was known about very clearly half a century before it was used. Half a century. Scientists knew if you gave them ether, you wouldn't feel pain, and they didn't use it, and people didn't demand it. It took a long time before those anxieties you just mentioned actually enabled people to say, well, okay, we can set that aside and actually use ether or chloroform. And, you know, why is that? That's one of the questions I ask in the book. And I think there are lots of answers to that question. But one answer to the question brings it back to what we were talking about just a minute ago, and that is about this Cartesian distinction between body and soul or mind. And, you know, in that early period, in the 18th century, they knew about how you could alleviate pain, but they were really frightened about making a break between body and soul. You know, they believed that the two were intertwined. If you get rid of one, in other words, if you let the body go to sleep, to die a little death, then the soul will as well. And therefore, you know, they're intertwined. So the great fears of, you know, separating the body from the soul. Of course, there are other reasons as well, such as religious reasons, you know, this idea that, well, if you die under anesthesia, then what happens? You know, you don't have time to repent. You don't have time to do anything. So there's also that. And there's also a very strong scientific, and for the period it was good science, idea that actually pain helps in healing, that pain is necessary. God gave us pain, or even if you don't believe in God, they said at the time, there's an evolutionary process. There's a reason for pain. It helps in healing. And also, of course, it, well, allegedly, it builds good character. I must say I didn't feel that myself when I was in hospital, but that was certainly what was felt at the time, that this was character forming and, you know, really good for you. And therefore, you know, getting rid of it actually was just not good for humanity.
You tell a story in the book of one man who thought it would be beneath his dignity to express pain. And then he goes through this operation and ends up dying after the operation. And which gets to that idea that science used to think that pain, expressing pain, is part of that healing process. Would you say something about this? Is in a section about gestures, which I kind of want to work through, but say something about that story first.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this goes back. This man went through a very, very serious operation, and he was determined not to express his absolute agony. I mean, real agony. And so he was silent. He bore it all inside himself as they were, you know, cutting him. And of course, that's the wrong thing to do, because what is the healing thing about pain is screaming, is the agony and the bodily expression of it. That is what's good. And of course, therefore, it follows the scientific knowledge of the day that the result of that was he would die, because, you know, he didn't allow his own body to work through that gesture of pain, that agony, those torments, having to be held down while you were being cut open. And he didn't allow that, and therefore he died because of it. Now, of course, we have to be careful here, because the poor man, because there's also kind of a real distinction made between his kind of extreme stoicism and, of course, manly, correct stoicism. Right. So, you know, his problem was he took it to a great extreme, You know, he was supposed to groan loudly in a manly fashion. He was supposed to roar like a tiger. He wasn't supposed to be absolutely silent like a rock. And that was his mistake. You know, and the other thing to say about gestures is that, you know, the gestures are still a main way that we communicate what we're going through. Right. And in a sense, one thing that physicians and medical professionals of all kinds have really struggled with is what you do if someone doesn't have the ability to create or to make those correct gestures. So in other words, the comatosed. Mm-hmm. The people who are unconscious or infants, you know, how do you read the body in pain? Is a question that some of the greatest minds have, you know, been really, really absorbed with over the centuries.
Or animals.
Or animals. Yes, indeed. In fact, you know, the whole thing about animals is that until, you know, very, very recently, there was a widely viewed scientific view. And remember, we're talking about proper science here the time, that animals, in fact, don't feel pain. So when, you know, you step on a dog's paw and he kind of squeals, or whatever dogs do, you know, that's just a automatic reflex. It's not real pain. What I find very, very interesting in these debates is that those same arguments were made about infants.
Yeah.
And those same arguments were made about infants until very, very, very recently indeed. So this whole argument, you know, well, let me take a few steps back. 18th century, there was this firm view that infants were exquisitely sensitive to pain.
Right.
But that all changed in the 1870s when certain scientific research, again, the best science of the time, in the 1870s, discovered that, in fact, infants were not fully wired. In other words, the pain processes weren't actually fully developed until much, much later. Some said as late as 2 or 3 years of age, in fact. And therefore, infants didn't feel pain. So when a child cried or screamed, that wasn't real pain. That was, again, like an animal, it was just a reflex action. Now, that view persisted from the 1870s right up until the 1970s, and even in many places in Britain and America into the 1980s. In other words, until the 1970s, infants were having full operations, amputations, stomach operations, you name it, without any analgesic, let alone anesthetic, because of this view. And that only changed really very, very recently.
Well, it gets us to a larger point in the book that, as you say, there is nothing democratic about pain, that the people who we've always perceived as being too sensitive to pain or not sensitive enough to pain, the young, you mentioned, but women, the poor, the working class, people of color, minorities, they've all fit into these ways we've thought differently about the way certain people feel or experience pain.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is kind of the sad bit. You know, the people who need help, who need sympathy, who need help the most, are the ones who generally are not seen as suffering as much, and are certainly not given as much analgesic, anesthetic, or even just basic human sympathy. You know, ethnic minorities, the poor, manual laborers. You know, not only are they consistently, right up until the present, I've got so much evidence for this, right up to the present, not only are they given significantly less pain relief than others, but they're also much more likely to be considered to be malingerers or hysterics. You know, it's ironic. There's a, you know, it's a catch-22 situation for these groups, because on the one hand, they are said to, they're more like the animals. Mm. They don't really feel. Therefore, they don't need as much anesthetic, analgesic as others. But on the other hand, they feel too much. Therefore, they're hysterical. Therefore, you shouldn't give them as much analgesic or anesthetic as others. So it's whatever they do, it's a catch-22 situation. And, you know, these things really blight the lives of people who need it the most. You know, we've just mentioned children, we've mentioned women, we've mentioned ethnic minorities, we've mentioned working, hard-working people, but also the elderly.
Yeah.
Again, the more elderly you are, the more pain you report, but the less sympathy and analgesics you get. You know, it's a terrible situation. And even the most well-meaning, and I do think they are well-meaning, the most well-meaning physicians and nurses, you know, when you actually question them, they talk about alleviating pain as opposed to eradicating pain. So in a sense, there's still this view that a certain amount of pain is natural, normal, inevitable, even when often it's not, in fact.
When we come back from a break, I want to ask you about how pain is social. It has a cultural kind of context. Joanna Burke is with us. Her book is The Story of Pain, From Prayer to Painkillers. We'll take a quick break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about why it's so difficult to define what pain is, because it seems like an obvious question, but it's so personal, so subjective, that it's really difficult to describe. The historian Joanna Burke has written The Story of Pain in her book, and it turns out what people mean by pain has changed in dramatic ways over the years. She's joining us to explain how knowing the story of pain will help us acknowledge our own sorrows, but also the sorrows of others. The book is The Story of Pain, From Prayer to Painkillers. She's joining us today from the Hellenic Radio in Athens, Greece. We need to talk about Peter Latham. This is a voice, you say, that throughout the process of writing this book and researching it, his voice repeatedly interrupted your thoughts, you say, during the process. Tell us who he is and what he kept telling you, what his voice was telling you throughout.
Yeah, Peter Latham was very, very influential 19th century physician. He was physician to the Queen, you know, very, very important figure. And I was kind of shocked when I first found him interrupting my thoughts, as you just said, because, you know, all my work up until this point had really dealt with poor people, women, ethnic minorities, and the downtrodden, the undertrodden people of this world. But, you know, he spoke in the language of a, you know, Victorian patriarch. to me as a feminist. And so I was shocked that I kept listening to him, because he was actually very, very wise. And he taught me a lot. And he talked a lot about, you know, what is pain. In fact, I discovered that he was a severe migraine sufferer for all his life. And, you know, he says, you know, is pain the same? It's just maybe for one person it's a little thing like a pinprick, and for another person it's agony like a migraine. You know, is it the same thing that we're talking about here, or are these totally different? And he said something that I found very sympathetic for me as an historian. He said, well, actually, pain is subjective, and therefore, you know, we just must listen to what people in pain are saying and take them at their word. So, you know, if someone says they're in pain, they are in pain. And that is what pain is. And that really struck me as something really quite profound and a very good way for me as a historian to progress, because I didn't have to interrogate people in the past. Oh, is he really in pain or is he not? If he or she is in pain, say they're in pain, they are in pain. But there was one thing that kind of disturbed me when I was reading his thing, that even though I accepted totally, and I still accept if the idea that if someone says they're in pain, they're in pain, there was something about his work that is disturbing, and that is he always capitalized pain. You know, so pain was always capital P, A-I-N. And this kind of reifying, if you like, making pain as a kind of independent object was something I thought, actually, that's not where I'm going to go.
Right.
Because I think that we need to understand pain is something that is fundamentally about human and indeed environmental interactions. In other words, it's not an entity, a reified capital P, A-I-N, but it is a lowercase pain, something that is interactive, It's between me and you. It's between me and my environment. Everything in my life informs what it is that I am feeling, that sensation of pain. And that's kind of what I went for in the book. So listening to how people, you know, real people, not fictive people, fictional people, real people talked, spoke, made images of their pain, and trying to understand what that was trying, what they were trying to tell us in those ways about their actual feeling states.
You see pain as a type of event. Explain that, because it's such an interesting philosophical conundrum in some ways.
Yeah, I think pain is a type of event. I mean two different things, or two related things, I should say. First, it's an event.
Right.
So pain is not just anything. Pain is something we recognize as painful. So in other words, we are taught that certain things are pain and other things are not. So for example, a gurgle in my stomach just before lunch is different from a stomach ache. Mm. And we are kind of taught that. So it's an event, and it's something that belongs to us. We know if something is painful, and no one can tell us it's not. We know it when we feel it. It's an event in our life, and it is something that we always are engaged with. We can't be neutral about this. It is an event that happens to us as individuals. But it's also a type of event, and that is what I mean by that is it something that we learn how to we learn how to deal with, we learn how to communicate, we learn how it is we should comport ourselves in order to elicit sympathy for what we are feeling. And I think that's really a very interesting and important way of thinking about it. One of the real problems that we all have when talking about pain is this idea pain is subjective, which is absolutely true. It is subjective. But it's something that we all have a language for, we all have words for. And those words are what enable us to communicate to other people. And in this sense, that's what I mean by when I say that, you know, pain is subjective, but it is always, and it's integral to the experience of pain, that it is interpersonal.
I wanted to ask you about how it works culturally, because you say in the book that from really the moment of birth, infants are initiated into these cultures of pain. And what one generation from the 18th century may have learned about pain would be very different from what an infant from a generation of the 20th, of the 21st century learned.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's a cultural distinction here. Explain that.
Yeah. You know, the understanding that we have, that we learn from infancy about our bodies, informs what we think of and what we experience as pain. So you use the example of an infant. You know, an infant in the 18th century would learn very quickly that some kinds of cries elicited sympathy and others elicited, oh, just grow up, dismissive attitudes. They learn that certain things are part of what the society around them recognizes as pain, and other things are actually dismissed. So the 18th century child learns that pain is something that moves, unlike what we'd think of today. In the 18th century, they had this kind of humorial notion of the body. So pain is something that moves throughout the body. It's like a fluid that shifts as the human being, as the person shifts, which is, of course, very, very different from the 19th and certainly 20th century, where the child learns that pain exists in a part of the body. So the whole organ kind of understanding of the body. So I have a pain here is something that you get very much in the 19th century and more recently, whereas it's not something that moves around the body, but it's located in a particular spot. I think that's just one example of, you know, how culture affects pain. But also, you know, it matters if you're a boy, what is pain. It matters, you know, everything in your life matters about in relationship to this. And physicians also learn different things and learn how to relate to patients in pain in very different ways. And I think that's another really important thing here, that you know, in the 18th century, just to make it more clear, in the 18th century, when there wasn't effective analgesics or medication, the doctor had to know everything about that person in order to diagnose what was wrong, what was causing the pain. So that doctor understood that he had to know why that pain was moving around the body. Partly that meant that he had to know about relationships. He had to know about the weather. He had to know about the diet of the person. This is a world away from physicians today, you know, solid organ type medicine, where the physician really just needs to have some tests done and identify where the problem is located.
Yeah.
And that's all that's needed. So in fact, if you like, the whole story of that individual is not relevant to the diagnosis anymore.
So that pain narrative became, perceived anyway, as useless. That your story of pain doesn't necessarily help me because I have other diagnostic tools that can help me get at your pain. One of the arguments
exactly.
I think you make is physicians need to think about going back to considering those pain narratives as an important part of the process.
Yeah, I agree totally. You know, when we go to a doctor now, when I go to the doctor, he barely looks at me. You know, he looks at his computer screen and he fills out some forms and he sends me off for various blood tests, which are very, very helpful. And but he's not interested in my story. He's not interested where I fit that pain into my whole life story. Whereas in the 18th century, that was absolutely crucial. Now, of course, I'm not knocking at all modern medicine. I come from a medical family. I'm very pro the most recent tests and everything. But I think that we do need to return to at least part of what those earlier doctors understood. And that was that they may be able to diagnose something. They may be able to tell me, yeah, that's a tumor, cancer tumor, or you know, your blood pressure is doing this. But if they're really going to help me, if they're going to really cure me, they actually need to take that a step further and help me understand my pain within a much, much wider context. You know, this was known from the 1950s, indeed. You know, when we get the discovery of the placebo effect, you know, which proved totally conclusively that, you know, it matters if the size of the pill, it matters if the physician is wearing a white coat, it matters, you know, the context of which in which you are being healed makes a difference. And in a partly what I'm saying is that let's take that really, really seriously. Let's also take these 18th century physicians and medical professionals very seriously and start looking much more at the whole person. And I think that modern medicine in combination with those other knowledges is a really important way to go if we really want to alleviate people's suffering, our own suffering indeed.
Mm. Let's talk about the role of religion in the way we perceive pain, the way we talk about pain. Would you tell the story of Joseph Townend? It's kind of an excruciating story in some ways, but it's instructive to the question of religion.
Yeah. Townsend, he was a very, very interesting character for a lot of reasons. But, you know, here is a laborer, a working class laborer who writes this most exquisite memoir. This is very, very unusual. And he writes this memoir, he starts his memoir telling about as a child, he was taking a big pot of hot water, boiling water off the fire. And I think he was 6 years of age. He was very young. Mm. And it tipped on him and basically burnt the entire side of his body. And his mother was very poor. The family were very, very poor. They couldn't afford medication. And in the end, his arm ended up being fused to the side of his body because they couldn't separate it. So his arm ended up being fused to the side of his body, which, of course, if you're a working class laborer in a Lancashire cotton factory, is not a good thing to happen to you. So when he was a teenager, he decided to get his arm freed and he went to the paupers' hospital. And he describes in excruciating detail, which, if you're into excruciating, read the book.
Yeah, for sure. It's a difficult story to hear.
Yes. I feel sick just thinking about it. He goes to the doctor, and you know what they do? Firstly, they cover his eyes. They blindfold him just with a piece of old cloth. They lead him blindfolded into this theater. Now, you know, we all talk about surgical theatres. Well, the reason we talk about surgical theatres is because they were theatres in that period of history. You know, they were literally theatres where people, medical students primarily, but also interested people, sat in the seats and watched something happen. In this case, they watched the physician put a knife through the web at the top of his arm and then with one brutal movement, cut through the entire length of his arm. And, you know, this is excruciatingly painful.
No anesthetic. But this was 23 years before.
No anesthetic, nothing at all. And, you know, blood everywhere. You know, you can imagine screaming, etc. And, but Townsend's response was really interesting. Firstly, he knew that this was necessary, but also he knew that the pain he was suffering was on account of his sins and that God was inflicting this punishment on him as a loving father. And so he was grateful to that. And so he offers up these prayers to God as he's recuperating. But then the following day, the surgeon comes in. Remember, middle class. Yeah. Townsend is a working class laborer. So the surgeon comes in, and Joseph Townsend puts out his left hand, because this happened on his right side, to shake his hand. And the surgeon is furious, and he grabs his left hand, he grabs his right arm, and which is still wrapped and wounded as of the day before, and he yanks it so that all the blood, black blood, gushes forth. And he says, "How dare you treat a gentleman like that?" In other words, shaking him with his left as opposed to his right hand. And the interesting thing is Townsend's response is acceptance that he did something wrong against a class thing here on this world as opposed to a deity in the other world. So this acceptance of pain, which runs through his entire story, tells us a great deal about real human beings and the way they try to make sense of suffering in this world.
Suffering, you write in the book, has a role in promoting personal as well as spiritual rebirth. This was a really important thing that John Brown, the philanthropist John Brown, was hit by a runaway horse and saw that affliction of pain as from God, as good.
Yep. Yeah, this is very, very common in this period. You know, I guess when there is no option of analgesics or anesthetics, when suffering is so much an everyday part of everyone's lives, really of whatever class, but of course particularly poorer people in community, giving yourself up to pain, accepting it, learning a lesson from the pain that's been inflicted, developing moral courage, moral fortitude, and also showing yourself to be someone who's learning from this also brings great esteem within your community. The worst thing really is to become hysterical or to go, sort of batty or, crazy hysterical with your pain, because that shows that, in fact, you haven't learned your lesson. You're not part of the community of believers and of good people. And therefore, you're not good. In fact, you're less likely to be given sympathy if you respond in that way. So people of the time, like we do today, we learn various scripts in order to elicit the sympathy that we all desperately, desperately need in these circumstances.
But don't you think that even though maybe the particular circumstances may have changed, that while there is that there's a more secular way of looking at the same concept, that it may not be God's, it may not be related to God, but that this idea of bearing pain builds character still seems to be part of Western culture.
Oh, it really is. I mean, and the religious aspect is still, of course, also very much a part of our lives.
Sure.
You know, a lot of us are true believers, and we deal with pain through prayer, through meditation, through communicating with our own religious communities. This is still a part of many of our lives. But also, the secular argument there is still really fundamentally based on those religious precepts. And that's why, you know, I do pay a lot of attention to religion in the book, because even the thing about no pain, no gain, you know, that comes from somewhere. And where that comes from is fundamentally religious. Bearing pain, building character, these are things that, particularly if you're certain kinds of people, very, very important. And, you know, just to take one example that we haven't mentioned so far, childbirth. You know, it's still a very important part of our culture that women in childbirth need to bear the pain, because that creates mother love, that creates women's character, which they're going to need in the future in raising their children, and that somehow this is women's lot. You know, these are all still with us today. That's why I think history is really important, because history actually says, well, you know, we didn't just invent these things yesterday. There's a reason for where we are now. And therefore, we need to think of reasons to be somewhere else, or to experiment with a different way of understanding pain, a different way of maybe breaking some of those ties in the past, but keeping others, being more creative about what we do with pain.
Joanna Burke is with us. Her book is The Story of Pain, From Prayer to Painkillers. We'll take another quick break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Dr. Joanna Burke. We're talking about her book, The Story of Pain, From Prayer to Painkillers. She's joining us from the Hellenic Radio in Athens, Greece. We were talking earlier about, I want to come back to this, the emergence now of anesthetics. 1846 is this decisive moment in pain. And now we have the sort of medical capacity to deal with pain. And there's all of this ambivalence, all of this anxiety about it. And I wanted to ask you about a couple of them. One of them was really interesting, is that there were worries that anesthetics would leave women morally compromised.
Yeah, this is really common. There was this argument that, well, you know, if you give women anesthetics, then they'll be interfered with in the operating theatre, that somehow the doctors, physicians were already getting too much power. There were fears that, you know, giving them this extra power where they had in front of them a lifeless body of someone who was completely unable to protect or defend her honor, in the absence, of course, of husbands or fathers or other male protectors, that somehow she would be vulnerable to attack. And indeed, many of those husbands, fathers, etc., also didn't want their wives or daughters to be passively asleep in front of a strange man. So those are really big, big anxieties of the period. And indeed, they still reoccur in certain groups today, certain immigrant groups today. We also see that. But it was so powerful at the time that, you know, remember, this is the time when a woman is never alone with a man who's not a father or a family member. So to have her totally helpless in front of a strange doctor was something that was quite legitimately, and I think rightly so, quite terrifying for many women.
You know, at some point this morning as I was preparing this conversation, I wrote the question, at what point did we come to terms with alleviating pain? Which seems so naive now. We really haven't come to terms with alleviating pain. Doesn't seem.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think we've come to terms with it at all. I think, you know, there is still under-medicalization of pain. There is still a real problem with certain groups in society being given less pain relief than others. And indeed, we need to forget this. I mean, we need not to forget this. But, you know, so often, we and myself included, point to problems with medical professionals not giving enough pain relief, et cetera, et cetera. But of course, it's not only that. That's also true. But also patients themselves are ambivalent about pain. Yeah. Patients are worried that they might get addicted. Patients are worried that if they ask for, you know, more pain relief, if they that means they're in more pain, and that means they're going to die. Therefore, they don't want to ask for more pain relief. Patients want to be good patients, like me. You know, when I was in the hospital bed, why didn't I tell the nurses that my morphine pump was not working? Because I want to be a good patient. You know, I didn't want to disturb the hardworking nurses. So it's also patients are worried about this. And we have to remember that, you know, some of these things are expensive as well. So poor patients also are worried about the cost. Matter of feeding your kids or, you know, getting some pain relief, I know what decision I would make.
But it seems like there's such a mixed message, though, because, I mean, if you think about the current addiction to opioids, which has become a massive problem in the United States, it must have compounded this question about our suspicion over pain. People going, you know, stealing opioids, getting addicted to opioids, those kinds of problems. I'm wondering how that has complicated all of this.
Yeah, it's a real problem, you know, particularly in the States, less so in my country, in Britain. But in the States, it's a massive problem. Yeah. And of course, that's one of the reasons why physicians are reluctant to give these drugs, because they're worried that they will be prosecuted, indeed, if you know, it turns out that, that they're being sold on the black market and whatever. I think, though, that, you know, these are complicated decisions that we have to make as societies, and they're complex for a reason, and that is that there is a real issue here. But I think we need to separate out this fear of addiction from the desire that we all do have to actually alleviate true suffering. And, you know, it's impossible to have that conversation without really looking seriously at both sides of the issue. And I think one side that's not given sufficient hearing is the side that says, actually, for people who are really in pain, it is actually not common for you to become addicted. That people in pain, if they are in pain, actually do regulate their own intake of these drugs, partly because, for reasons I just gave, they're also afraid they're going to become addicted, but also partly because they just want to alleviate their pain. And I think as a society, we need to think, well, what are our priorities? Our priorities are actually alleviating the pain of people who are suffering hellish, and I mean that quite literally, hellish agony. Or is it about fears of addiction? And those two things will always be in conflict. And as a society, we have to make our decision.
Even today, you say half of cancer patients are suffering needlessly. And this was interesting. You write this, you say, evidence has emerged that as the severity of a person's pain increased, so did the extent to which nurses and other clinicians underestimated it.
Yeah. That, you know, when I did that research, and I've got a huge number of footnotes for all these things, you know, it actually made me cry, because no one is saying that these people are addicts. You know, these are people dying, and these are people who are desperate not only for pain relief but also for sympathy, and they're exactly the ones we're failing. It's those people, it's the elderly people, it's poor people who have worked really, really hard all their lives, and their bodies simply cannot take it anymore. And that these are the people I think we're all failing.
You say in the book, it seems like there's reason to be pessimistic, I have to say, because you say there's evidence educating clinicians in pain management only makes a marginal difference. And there's this historian, an ethicist you quote in the book, Daniel Goldberg, who said that any attempt at relieving people's suffering needs to strike at the root cause, the complex social and cultural matrices involved, which is essentially what your book is about. Would you say something about that, finally, the idea of us dealing with this, the cultural components of all of this, the social components of all of this? Clinicians, doctors, they need to be aware of that in order for us to get a true grip on dealing with pain, I suppose.
Yeah, doctors definitely need to be, or medical professionals more generally, need to be more educated about this. We need changes in our medical education primarily so that people are trained to listen. Listening is not something easy. You know, listening to pain hurts. Doctors hurt when they're listening to some of these accounts of pain. And therefore, we need to, they need to, and we all need to, learn how to do that. But I think we can't simply blame doctors or medical professionals, that this is a question for our society much more generally. And it's about fundamental attitudes towards pain, towards suffering, towards sympathy, and what we can really do to help alleviate the suffering of those around us. And I think Daniel Goldberg's really great at this, because one of the things he's saying, and I agree 100%, is that if we are to alleviate suffering in our society, we need to strike at the heart of what is causing it. And what is causing suffering is inequality, is the lack of care for other people, and a fear of sympathizing with others, a fear of listening to other people, because it hurts us when we're listening. And I think that's kind of the message I want to give here in this book. And certainly I learned a lot about how I also deal with friends, family, who I see in pain. In the course of writing this book, you know, I did have to not only suffer myself, but I also became much more sensitive than I think I ever was before to my friends and people I knew who were suffering. And, you know, learned that actually just listening sometimes is actually really, really helpful.
Joanna Burke. Her book is The Story of Pain, From Prayer to Painkillers. She has another book called War and Art that's coming out later this year. You're busy, Joanna Burke.
Yeah, I am busy, but it's so great being a historian. I love writing history.
Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thanks so much, Doug. Really like talking to you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks today to the Hellenic Radio in Athens, Greece. David Boyle is our intern. We had technical direction from Adrian Moranville. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.